and judging from the increasing coolness of the wind, the temperature would continue to drop until sunrise. It was difficult to see much beyond the outer fires due to the clouded darkness and the smoke given off by the quick-burning wood. Somehow the camp seemed smaller from this viewpoint than it had from the heights of the Dragon's Teeth. Flick could not get the same sense of depth from his present position, but he did not try to fool himself. Despite what it appeared to be from where he crouched, he knew that it stretched for over a mile in all directions. Once past the inner sentry line, he would have to pick his way through thousands of sleeping gnomes and trolls, past hundreds of fires bright enough to reveal his identity, and all the way avoid contact with the enemy soldiers who were still awake. The first miscalculation the Veilman made would give him away. Even if he managed to avoid discovery, he still had to locate the prisoners and the sword. He shook his head in doubt and moved forward slowly. The natural curiosity of the Veilman prompted him to linger near the fringes of the firelight to study further the gnomes and trolls still awake, but he resisted the impulse, reminding himself that he didn't have much time as it was. Though he had lived all his life on the same earth with these two foreign races, they were like species from another world to the little Southlander. During his journey to Perrinor, he had fought the cunning, savage gnomes several times, once hand-to-hand in the labyrinth passages of the Druid's Keep. But he still knew little about them. They were simply an enemy who had tried to kill him. He had learned nothing of the giant trolls, a habitually reclusive people dwelling principally in the northern mountains and their hidden valleys. In any event, Flick knew that the army was under the leadership of the warlock lord, and there was no question as to what his goals were. He waited until the wind carried the smoke from the burning fires between the closest sentry and himself in a series of billowing gusts, then rose and strolled in a casual manner toward the encampment. He had carefully selected an entry point where the soldiers were all sleeping. The smoke and the night masked his bulky form as he moved out of the shadows and into the circle of fires nearest to him. A moment later he stood in the midst of the soundly sleeping forms. The sentry continued to stare blankly into the darkness behind him, unaware of the hurried passage. Flick wrapped the cloak and head covering closely about his body, making certain that only his hands were immediately visible to anyone passing by. His face was a dim shadow beneath the hood. He glanced about quickly, but there was no movement by anyone close at hand. He had made it this far unnoticed. He breathed deeply of the cool night air to steady himself, then tried to gauge his position in relation to the center of the encampment. He chose a direction which he believed would take him directly toward the hub of the burning fires, glanced about once more to reassure himself, then moved forward with steady, measured steps. Now there could be no turning back. What he saw, what he heard, what he experienced deep within his mind that night left an indelible print in his memory that would stay with him forever. It was like a strange, somehow elusive nightmare of sights and sounds, creatures and shapes from another time and place, things that never were in and could never belong to his own world, and yet had been cast onto it like so much driftwood from an endless sea. Perhaps it was the night and the wafting smoke from the hundreds of dying fires that clouded his normal senses and created this dreamlike experience. Perhaps, too, it was the after effect of a tired, frightened mind that had never conceived of the existence of such creatures, nor imagined their number could be so vast. The night passed in slow minutes and endless hours as the little Veilman wound his way through the giant encampment, shielding his face from the light of the fires as he moved steadily forward, his eyes searching, studying, and always looking further. Cautiously, he picked his tortured way over thousands of sleeping bodies huddled close to the flames, often blocking his progress entirely, each another chance that he might be discovered and killed. There were times when he was certain that he had been discovered, times when his hand moved swiftly, silently to the small hunting knife, his heart dying within him as he prepared to fight for his freedom at the cost of his life. Again and again, men came toward him as if they knew he was an imposter, as if they would stop him and expose him to everyone. But each time they passed by, without pausing, without speaking, and Flick would be left alone once again, a forgotten figure in a gathering of thousands. Several times he passed close to groups of men talking and joking in low tones as they huddled around the fires, rubbing their hands and drawing from the crackling flames what little heat there was to protect them against the growing cold of the night. Twice, perhaps three times, they nodded or waved as he pushed past them, his face lowered, the cloak held close about his body, and he would make some feeble gesture in acknowledgement. Time and again he was afraid he had made a wrong move, failed to speak when he should, walked where he was not permitted. But each time the terrible moment of doubt vanished as he hurried on, and he found himself alone once more. He wandered through the immense camp for hours without finding any clue to the whereabouts of Shay, Eventine, or the Sword of Shannara. As morning drew near, he began to despair of finding anything. He had passed countless fires, burning low and dying with the close of night, gazed on a sea of sleeping bodies, some with faces turned skyward, some with blankets all around them, all unknown. There had been tents everywhere, marked by the standards of the enemy leaders, both gnome and troll, but there had been no guards stationed before them to distinguish them in importance. A few he had checked closely on a chance that he might stumble onto something, but he had found nothing. He listened to snatches of conversation between the gnomes and trolls who were not sleeping, trying to remain inconspicuous and at the same time come close enough to hear what was being said. But the troll tongue was completely foreign, and what little he understood of the garbled gnome speech consisted of useless information. It was as if no one knew anything of the two missing men and the sword, as if they had never been brought to this camp at all. Flick began to wonder if Al-Anon had been completely mistaken about the trail signs they had followed these past few days. He glanced apprehensively at the clouded night sky. He could not be certain of the time, but he knew there could be no more than several hours of darkness remaining. For a moment he panicked, abruptly realizing that he might not even have enough time to find his way back to where Al-Anon was concealed. But shaking off his fear, he quickly reasoned that in the confusion of breaking camp at dawn, he would be able to slip quickly back through the sleepy hunters and make the short dash for the slopes of the Dragon's Teeth before the sun found him. There was a sudden movement in the darkness off to his right, and into the firelight trudged four massive troll warriors, all fully armed, muttering in low tones among themselves as they moved past the startled Veilmen. On impulse more than reason, Flick fell in several yards behind them, curious as to where they might be going dressed in full battle array while it was still night. They were moving at right angles to the course the disguised Flick had chosen to follow into the encampment, and he stayed just behind them in the shadows as they trudged steadily through the sleeping army. Several times they passed darkened tents that Flick believed might be their destination, but they continued on without pausing. The little Veilman noticed that the style of the encampment was changing rapidly in this particular area. There were more tents than before, some with high, lighted canopies that silhouetted men moving within. There were fewer common soldiers sleeping on the chill earth, but more sentries patrolling between the well-fed fires that lighted the open spaces between tents. Flick found it harder to remain hidden in this new light. To avoid questions and to protect against an increased risk of discovery, he moved right up behind the marching trolls as if he were one of them. They passed numerous sentries that offered short greetings and watched as they passed, but no one attempted to question the heavily cloaked gnome who scampered along at the rear of the small procession. Then abruptly, the trolls turned left and automatically Flick turned with them, only to find himself almost on top of a long, low tent guarded by more armed trolls. There was no time to turn back or avoid being seen, so when the procession came to a halt before the tent, the fearful Veilman kept right on walking, moving past them as if he were oblivious to what was taking place. The guards evidently failed to think there was anything out of the ordinary, all glancing briefly his way as he shuffled past, the cloak pulled closely about him, and in an instant he was beyond them, alone in the blackness of the shadows. He halted sharply, sweat running down his body beneath the heavy clothing, his breathing short and labored. There had only been a second to glance through the open front of the lighted tent, between the towering troll sentries holding the long iron pikes. Only a second to see the crouched, black-winged monster that stood within, surrounded by the lesser forms of both trolls and gnomes. But there was no mistaking one of those deadly creatures that had hunted them across the four lands. There was no mistaking the chill feeling of terror that ran through the Veilman's body as he stood breathlessly in the shadows to still his pounding heart. Something vitally important was taking place inside that heavily guarded tent. Perhaps the missing men and the sword were there, held by the servants of the warlock lord. It was a chilling thought, and Flick knew that he had to get a look inside. His time was up, his luck run out. The guards alone were deterrent enough to anyone trying to pass through the open flaps, and the added presence of the skull-bearer made the idea suicidal. Flick sat back on his heels in the darkness between the tents and shook his head hopelessly. The enormity of the task utterly discouraged any hope for success, yet what other course lay open? If he returned to Alanon now, they would know nothing more than they had known previously, and his arduous night of creeping about the enemy encampment would have been for nothing. He gazed expectantly at the night sky, as if it might hold some clue to the answer to his problem. The cloud bank remained solidly in position overhead, hanging ominously between the light of the moon and stars and the blackness of the sleeping earth. The night was almost over. Flick rose and pulled the cloak closely about his chilled body once again. Fate may have decided that he should come all these torturous miles only to be killed in a foolish gamble, but Shay depended on him. Perhaps Alanon and the others as well. He had to know what was in that tent. Slowly, cautiously, he began to inch his way forward. The dawn came quickly, a sullen gray lightening of the eastern sky, heavy with mist and silence. The weather had not improved below the Strelaheim, south of the persistent wall of darkness that marked the advance of the warlock lord. Huge thunderclouds remained locked overhead like an ominous shroud covering its earthen corpse. Near the base of the western dragon's teeth, the enemy sentries had abandoned their night watch to return to the awakening encampment of the Northland army. Alanon sat quietly in the shelter of the boulder-strewn slope, the long, black cloak that was wrapped loosely around his lean, reed-like body, offering little protection against either the chill dawn air or the faint drizzle that was rapidly turning into a heavy downpour. He had been there all night, his eyes watching, searching for some sign of Flick, his hopes slowly fading as the sky lightened in the east and the enemy came to life. Still he waited, hoping against the odds that the little Veilman had somehow managed to conceal his identity, somehow managed to slip through the camp undetected and find his missing brother, the elven king, and the sword, then somehow managed to work his way clear of the pickets before daylight to reach freedom. The encampment was breaking up. The tents disassembled and packed as the huge army fell into columns that covered the vast plain like giant black squares. Finally, the fighting machine of the warlock lord began to march southward in the direction of Kern, and the giant druid came down out of the rocks where he could be seen by the missing Veilman if he were anywhere close at hand. There was no movement. No sound but the wind blowing softly across the grasslands, and the tall, dark figure stood silently. Only the eyes betrayed the keen bitterness he felt. At last the druid turned southward, choosing a course parallel to that of the army marching ahead. Giant strides quickly ate up the distance between them as the rain began to fall in heavy sheets, and the vast emptiness of the plains was left behind. Minyan Lee reached the winding Myrmidon River immediately north of the island city of Kern only minutes before dawn. Alanon had not been wrong when he had warned the prince that he would have a difficult time slipping through the enemy lines undetected. The sentry outposts extended beyond the perimeter of the sprawling plain encampment, running west above the Myrmidon from the southern edge of the Dragon's Teeth. Everything north of that line belonged to the warlock lord. Enemy patrols roamed unchallenged along the southern boundaries of the towering Dragon's Teeth, guarding the few passages that cut through these formidable peaks. Balinor, Hendel, and the Elven brothers had managed to break the security of one of these enemy patrols in the High Kennan Pass. Minyan did not have the protective shelter of the mountains in which to conceal himself from the Northlanders. Once he had left Alanon and Flick, he was forced to proceed directly across the flat, open grasslands that stretched south to the Myrmidon. But the Highlander had two things in his favor. The night remained clouded and completely impenetrably black, making it nearly impossible to see more than several yards ahead. More important than this, Minyan was a tracker and hunter without equal in the Southland. He could move through this shroud-like blackness with speed and stealth, undetected by any but the most sensitive ears. So it happened that he moved silently from the side of his two companions, still angered that Alanon had forced him to give up the search for Shay in order that he might warn Balinor and the people of Callahorn of the impending invasion. He felt strangely uneasy about leaving Flick alone with the mysterious and unpredictable druid. He had never completely trusted the giant mystic, knowing that the man was keeping the truth about the Sword of Shannara hidden from them, knowing that there was more to Alanon than he had chosen to tell them. They had done everything the druid had commanded of them in blind faith, trusting him implicitly each time a crisis had arisen. Each time he had been right, but still they had failed to gain possession of the sword, and they had lost Shay. Now, on top of everything else, it appeared the Northland army would successfully invade the Southland. Only the border kingdom of Callahorn stood ready to resist the assault. Having seen the awesome size of the invader, Minyan did not see how even the legendary border legion could hope to withstand such a mighty force. His own common sense told him that the only hope was to stall the advancing enemy long enough to unite the elven and dwarf armies with the border legion, and then strike back. He felt certain the missing sword was lost to them, and that even when they relocated Shay, there would be no further opportunity to search for the strange weapon. He uttered a low oath as his exposed knee jammed painfully against the sharp edge of a jutting boulder, and he turned his attention to the matter at hand, all further speculation about the future put aside for the time being. Like a lean, black lizard, he skimmed noiselessly down the low slopes of the dragon's teeth, winding his torturous way through the maze of knife-edged boulders and rocks that covered the mountainside, the sword of Lee and the long ash bow strapped securely to his back. He reached the base of the slope without encountering anyone, and he peered into the darkness. There was no sign of life. He moved cautiously onto the grass-covered plainlands, inching forward a few yards at a time, pausing periodically to listen. He knew the sentry lines had to be posted close to this point to be effective, but it was impossible to see anyone. At last, he rose to his feet, as silent as the shadows all about him. Hearing nothing, he began to walk slowly southward through the wall of darkness, his hunting knife held loosely in one hand. He walked for long minutes without incident and had just begun to relax in the belief that he had somehow slipped through the enemy lines without either of them knowing it, when he heard a small noise. He froze in mid-stride, trying to locate the source, and then it came again, a low cough from someone in the darkness directly in front of him. A sentry had given himself away just in time to save the Highlander from stumbling into him. One cry would have brought others in an instant. Menyon dropped into a crouch on his hands and knees, the dagger clutched tightly. He began to creep forward toward the source of the cough, his movement soundless. At last his eyes were able to discern the dim outline of someone standing silently before him. From his small size, the sentry was clearly a gnome. Menyon waited a few minutes longer to be certain that the gnome had his back turned to him. Then he crept still closer until he was within several feet. In one fluid motion, he rose to tower over the unsuspecting sentry, one steel-like arm gripping the fellow's throat, cutting off the cry of warning before it could escape. The butt end of the knife came down sharply on the exposed head just back of the ear, and the unconscious gnome crumpled to the earth. The Highlander did not pause, but slipped ahead into the darkness, knowing there would be others close at hand, and eager to move beyond their range of hearing. He held the dagger ready, anticipating that there might be still another sentry line. The chill wind blew steadily, and the long minutes of the night crawled on. Finally, he was at the Myrmidon, just above the island city of Kern, its lights faint in the distant south. He paused at the top of a small rise which dropped off gradually and sloped downward to form the north bank of the swift river. He remained in a half-crouch, his long hunting cloak wrapped about his lean frame to protect himself from the growing chill of the dawn wind. He was surprised and relieved that he had reached the river without running into still other enemy pickets. He suspected that his earlier assumption had been correct, and that he had passed through at least one other sentry line without realizing it. Gazing carefully around, the Prince of Lee assured himself that no one else was about, then rose and stretched wearily. He knew he had to cross the Myrmidon farther downriver if he wished to avoid a chilling swim in the icy waters. Once he reached a point directly across from the island, he was certain he would find a boat or ferry service to the city. Hitching his weapons higher on his back and smiling grimly against the cold, he began to walk southward along the river rise. He had not gone very far, perhaps no more than 1,000 yards, when the rushing of the dawn wind faded for an instant, and in the sudden stillness he heard an unfamiliar murmur from somewhere ahead. Instantly he dropped to the ground, his dark form flat against the small rise. The wind rushed back into his straining ears as he listened in the blackness. The gusting breeze died a second time, and again he heard the low murmur, but this time he was certain of its origin. It was the muffled sound of human voices carried out of the darkness ahead near the bank of the river. The Highlander crawled hurriedly back over the rise to where the terrain again shielded him from the faint lights of the distant city. Then he rose and moved forward in a half-crouch, running parallel to the river, his passing noiseless and swift. The voices grew louder and more distinct, and at last seemed to come from directly behind the grassy rise. He listened a minute longer, but found it impossible to decipher what was being said. Cautiously, he crawled on his stomach to the top of the rise, where he was able to make out a group of dark figures huddled next to the Myrmidon. The first thing that caught his eye was the boat pulled up onto the riverbank and tied to a low bush. There was his transportation, if he could get to it, but he discarded the idea almost instantly. Standing in a tight circle next to the moored boat were four very large armed trolls, their huge black bulks unmistakable even in this poor light. They were speaking with a fifth figure, smaller and slighter in build, his robes clearly marking him as a Southlander. Menyon studied them a moment with great care, trying to make out their faces, but the dim light gave him only brief glimpses of the man, and he didn't appear to be anyone Menyon had ever encountered previously. A small, dark beard covered the thin, shallow face of the stranger, and he had a peculiar habit of stroking the little beard in short, nervous pats while he talked. Then the Prince of Lee saw something else. To one side of the circle of men was a large bundle covered with a heavy cloak and securely tied. Menyon studied it dubiously, unable to tell what it was in the darkness. Then, to his astonishment, the bundle moved slightly, enough to convince the Highlander that there was something alive beneath the heavy coverings. Desperately, he tried to think of a way he might move closer to the small party, but already he was too late. The four trolls and the stranger were parting company. One of the trolls moved over to the mysterious bundle, and in one effortless heave threw it over his broad, bulky shoulder. The stranger was returning to the boat, loosening the fastenings and climbing in, the oars lowered to the choppy waters. There were several parting words exchanged, and Menyon caught snatches of the brief conversation, including something about having the situation well in hand. The final comment as the boat moved out into the swift waters was a warning from the stranger to wait for further word from him on the prince. Menyon inched back a bit on the damp grass of the little rise, watching the man and the small boat disappear into the misty darkness of the Myrmidon. Dawn was breaking at last, but it came in the form of a dim, hazy grayness that hampered visibility almost as effectively as the night. The sky was still overcast by low-hanging cumulus clouds that threatened to drop to the earth itself should they swell further. A heavy rain would fall before much longer, and already the air was coated with a damp, penetrating mist that soaked the Highlander's clothing and chilled the exposed skin. The huge Northland army would be on the march toward the island city of Kern within the hour, probably reaching it by midday. There was little time remaining for him to warn its citizens of the impending assault. An onslaught of men and weapons against which the city could not hope to defend itself for long. The people had to be evacuated immediately and taken to Tirsis or farther south for protection. Balinor had to be warned that time had run out, that the Border Legion must assemble and fight a delaying action until reinforced by the dwarf and elven armies. The Prince of Lee knew there was no time to ponder further the mysterious meeting he had just accidentally witnessed, but he lingered a moment longer as the four trolls turned from the riverbank, carrying the struggling bundle, and moved toward the rise to his right. Menyon was certain that someone had been taken prisoner by the stranger in the boat and turned over to these soldiers of the Northland army. This night meeting had been prearranged by both parties, and the exchange made for reasons known only to them. If they had gone to all that trouble, the prisoner must be someone very important to them, and therefore important to the warlock lord. Menyon watched the trolls move away from him into the heavy morning mist, still undecided as to whether he should intervene. Alanon had given him a task to complete, a vital task that might save thousands of lives. There was no time for wild forays in enemy country just to satisfy personal curiosity, even if it meant saving Shay. Suppose it was Shay they had taken prisoner? The thought flashed through the impetuous mind, and instantly the decision had been made. Shay was the key to everything. If there was any chance that he was the captive wrapped in that bundle, Menyon had to try to rescue him. He leaped to his feet and began running swiftly northward, back in the direction from which he had just come, trying to stay on a course parallel to that taken by the trolls. In the heavy mist, it was difficult to keep his sense of direction, but Menyon had no time to be concerned with that. It was going to be extremely difficult to take that prisoner away from four armed trolls, especially when any one of them was easily a match physically for the slight Highlander. There was the added danger that they might at any point pass back through the sentry lines of the Northland outposts. If he failed to stop them before then, he was finished. Any chance of rescue depended on keeping open an escape route to the Myrmidon. Menyon felt the first rains of the coming storm strike his face as he ran, and the thunder rumbled ominously overhead as the wind began to grow in force. Desperately, he searched through the rolling clouds of mist and fog for some sign of his quarry, but there was nothing to be seen. Certain that he had been too slow and had missed them, he raced at breakneck speed across the grasslands, charging like a wild black shadow through the mist, dodging the small trees and clumps of brush, his eyes searching the empty flatlands. The rain beat against his face and ran into his eyes, blinding him, forcing him to slow down momentarily to wipe away the warm haze of mingled rain and perspiration. He shook his head in anger. They had to be somewhere close. He couldn't have lost them. Abruptly, the four trolls appeared out of the fog behind him and off to the left. Menyon had misjudged and completely overtaken and passed them. He dropped into a crouch behind a small clump of bushes and watched a moment as the four moved closer. If they stayed on their present course, they would pass almost next to a large clump of scrub brush farther ahead, still beyond their vision but within Menyon's. The Highlander bounded from cover and raced back into the mist until he could no longer see the trolls. If they had seen him make that quick dash into the fog, he was through. They would be expecting him when they reached the scrub brush. But if not, he would spring his ambush there and make a break for the river. He cut back across the plains to his left until he reached the seclusion of the brush where, panting heavily, he dropped to all fours and peered cautiously through the branches. For a moment there was nothing but the fog and the rain, and then four bulky figures appeared out of the gray mist, moving steadily toward his place of concealment. He threw off the cumbersome hunting cloak, already soaked through by the morning rains. He would need speed to elude the massive trolls once he managed to get the prisoner away from them, and the cloak would only slow him down. He removed the heavy hunting boots as well. At his side he placed the sword of Lee, its bright blade drawn clear of the leather sheath. Hurriedly, he fitted the loosened string to the great ash bow and withdrew two long black arrows from their casing. The trolls were closing quickly on his cover now, their dark forms visible through the leafy branches of the brush. They walked in pairs, one of the foremost carrying the limp form of the bound prisoner. They came carelessly toward the hidden man, obviously at ease in territory they believed entirely under the control of their own forces. Menyon rose slowly to one knee, a black arrow fitted to the long bow, and waited silently. The unsuspecting trolls were almost on top of the scrub brush when the first arrow flew from out of nowhere with a sharp hum, striking the fleshy calf muscle of the bulky Northlander carrying the prisoner. In a roar of mingled rage and pain, the troll dropped his burden and fell, clutching the injured leg with both hands. In that instant of shock and confusion, Menyon fired the second arrow, scoring a solid hit to the exposed shoulder of the second member of the front pair, spinning the massive form entirely about so that he stumbled wildly into the two behind him. Without pausing, the agile Highlander sprang free of the scrub brush and rushed the amazed trolls, yelling and swinging the sword of Lee. The trolls had dropped back a step or two from the momentarily forgotten prisoner, and the quick attacker swept the limp form up onto one shoulder with his free arm before the astonished Northlanders could act. In another instant, he had swept past them, his sword cutting into the forearm of the nearest troll, who made a vain effort to stop the fleet form. The path to the Myrmidon lay open. Two trolls, one uninjured and the other slightly wounded, gave immediate chase, lumbering heavily across the rain-covered grasslands in determined silence. Their cumbersome armor and large frames slowed them down considerably, but they moved faster than Menyon had expected, and they were refreshed and strong while he was already tiring. Even without the hunting cloak and boots, the lean Highlander could not run very fast while carrying the still-bound prisoner. The rain had begun to fall in increasingly heavier sheets, winds swept and stinging against his skin as he forced his aching body to run faster still. In leaps and bounds he streaked across the grasslands, twisting past small trees, dodging scrub brush and water-soaked potholes. Even in bare feet, his footing on the wet, slippery grass was unsure. Several times he stumbled and fell to his knees, only to bound immediately to his feet to run again. There were hidden rocks and thorn-tipped plants scattered through the soft grasses, and soon his feet were cut and bleeding freely. But he didn't feel the pain, and he raced onward. The vast plains alone were witness to the strange race between the huge, lumbering hunters and the shadow-like quarry as they labored southward through the driving rains and the chilling wind. They ran without hearing, without seeing, without feeling through the panoramic emptiness, and there was nothing to break the terrible silence but the rush of the gusting wind in the runner's ears. It became a lonely, fearful ordeal of survival, a trial of spirit and stamina that demanded from the youthful Prince of Lee his final, complete reserve of strength. Time ceased to exist for the fleeing Highlander as he forced his legs to move when the muscles had long since passed the normal end of endurance. And still, there was no river. He no longer looked back to see if the trolls were closing. He could sense their presence, hear their labored breathing in his mind. They must be closing the distance rapidly. He had to run faster. He had to reach the river and free Shay. In his near exhaustion, he unconsciously referred to the person wrapped in the bundle as his friend. He had known immediately upon grasping the mysterious prisoner that he was small and slight of build. There was no reason to believe it might not be the missing Veilman. The bundled captive was awake and moving awkwardly as the Highlander ran, speaking in muffled phrases to which Menyon replied in short, gasping assurances that they were close to safety. The rain suddenly intensified in force until it was impossible to see more than a few feet in any direction, and the sodden plains turned quickly into a grass-tipped marsh. Then Menyon fell over a water-covered root and tumbled headlong into the muddied grass, his precious burden falling in a struggling heap beside him. Bruised and exhausted, the Highlander raised himself to his hands and knees, the great sword held ready, and looked back for his pursuers. To his relief, they were nowhere in sight. In the heavy rain and fog, they had momentarily lost him. But even the limited visibility would only slow them down for a few minutes, and then... Menyon shook his head sharply to clear the haze of rain and weariness from his eyes, then crawled quickly to the waterlogged heap of clothing that bound the struggling prisoner. Whoever was in that hunting cloak was in good enough shape to run beside him, and Menyon's strength was nearly gone. He knew he could carry the added weight no farther. Awkwardly, hardly aware of what he was doing, the Highlander sawed at the tough bonds with his sword. It had to be Shay, his mind told him over and over. It had to be Shay. The trolls and that stranger had gone to so much trouble not to be seen, had been so secretive. The bonds snapped as the sword finally severed them. It had to be Shay. The ropes unwound and the cloak flew open as the person within struggled into the open air. An astonished Minyan Lee wiped the rain from his blinking eyes and stared. He had rescued a woman. Chapter 24. A woman? Why would the Northlanders kidnap a woman? Minyan stared through the pouring rain into the clear blue eyes that blinked back at him uncertainly. She was no ordinary woman in any case. She was strikingly beautiful, deeply browned skin covering the finely formed features of the rounded face, a slim, graceful figure clothed in a silky material, and her hair. He had never seen anything like it. Even wetted and plastered against her face by the driving rain, falling shoulder length and lower in long, wistful strands, the strange color showed through the grayness of the morning in a deep reddish hue. For a moment he gazed at her in a half-conscious trance. Then the throbbing pain from his cut and bleeding feet recalled him to his present situation and the grave danger still facing them. Quickly he climbed back to his feet, wincing with the pressure on his exposed soles, the weariness flooding through him until he thought he would collapse in total exhaustion. His mind battled fiercely for several long moments as he swayed almost drunkenly, bracing himself on the great sword. The frightened face of the girl. Yes, she could still be called a girl, he thought suddenly, peered up at him out of a gray haze. Then she was on her feet next to him, holding him up, talking to him in low, distant tones. He shook his head and nodded stupidly. "It's all right now. I'm all right." The words sounded garbled as he spoke. "Run for the river. We have to reach Kern." They began moving again through the mist and the rain, walking rapidly, at times staggering on the uncertain footing of the marshy grasslands. Minyan felt his head begin to clear and his strength return as they walked, the girl next to him, her hands locked onto his arm, half holding on to him for her own support, half helping to support him. His keen eyes searched the gloom about them for some sign of the prowling trolls, certain that they were not too far away. Then abruptly his ears picked up a new sound— the pounding, rushing throb of the Myrmidon, its rain-filled waters overflowing the lowland banks as it swept southward toward Kern. The girl heard it too, and gripped his arm tightly in encouragement. Moments later they stood on the crest of the small rise that ran parallel with the north bank. The swift river had long since flooded its low banks and was continuing to rise. Minyan had no idea where they stood in relation to Kern, but he realized that if they crossed at the wrong point, they would miss the island entirely. The girl seemed to recognize the problem. Taking his arm, she began moving downstream along the low rise, peering across the river into the gloom. Minyan let her lead him without question, his own eyes casting about anxiously for some sign of the pursuing trolls. The rain had begun to slacken, and the mist was beginning to clear. It would not be long before the storm would end and visibility return, leaving the two revealed to the persistent hunters. They had to chance a crossing quickly. Minyan did not know how long the young woman led him along the river's edge, but at last she halted and indicated in hurried gestures a small skiff drawn up against the grassy embankment. Quickly the Highlander strapped the sword of Lee to his back, and together the two pushed off into the swift waters of the Myrmidon. The river was icy, and the shock of the extreme cold from the spray of the foam-tipped waves jarred Minyan to the bone. He rode fiercely across the swift current as it swept them downriver with terrific force, frequently turning them about completely as they fought to reach the other side. It was a wild, careening battle between river and man that seemed to go on endlessly, and at last everything became hazy and numb in Minion's mind. What happened in the end was never clear to him. He was vaguely aware of hands reaching to pull him from the skiff to a grassy bank where he collapsed in a breathless stupor. He heard the girl's soft voice speaking to him, and then there was blackness and numbness all about him as he lapsed into unconsciousness. He drifted in and out of darkness and sleep, plagued by an uneasy sense of danger that prodded at his tired mind and demanded that he rise and stand ready. But his body could not respond, and finally he dropped off into a deep slumber. When he awoke, it was still light out and the rain was falling in a slow, steady drizzle through deep gray skies. He lay in the warmth and comfort of a bed, dry and rested, his torn feet cleaned and bandaged, and the terrible race to escape the Northlanders behind him. The slow rain beat peacefully on the paned glass windows that let in the daylight through the wood and stone walls. He glanced idly around the finely furnished chamber, realizing quickly that this was not the home of an average citizen, but of royalty. There were insignia and crests on the woodwork that Menyon knew to belong to the kings of Callahorn. For a moment the Highlander lay quietly and studied the room in silent leisure, allowing the sleep to disperse and his rested mind to awaken fully. He saw a dry set of clothes lying on a chair near the bed, and was just about to rise and dress when the door opened, and an elderly serving woman appeared, carrying a tray of steaming food. Nodding politely and smiling, she hastened to the bed with the tray and deposited it on the Highlander's lap, propping him up with pillows and urging him to eat it all while it was still hot. Strangely, she reminded Menyon of his own mother, a kind, fussy woman who had died when he was 12. The serving lady lingered until he had taken the first bite, then turned away and went out again, closing the door quietly behind her. Menyon ate slowly, savoring the excellent food, feeling the strength return to his body. It occurred to him only after he had finished almost half the meal that he had not eaten for over 24 hours. Or perhaps it had been longer. He glanced again through the window to the rain beyond, unable to tell if it was even the same day. It might be the following day. In a flash, he recalled his original purpose in coming to Kern, to warn them of the impending invasion by the Northland army. He might already be too late. He was still frozen with the thought, a fork raised halfway to his mouth when the door opened a second time. It was the young woman he had rescued, refreshed and dry now, dressed in a flowing gown of warm, mixed colors, her long red tresses combed and shining even in the gray light of the rain-clouded day. She was easily the most stunning woman the Prince of Lee had ever encountered. Remembering suddenly the half-raised fork, he lowered it to the tray and smiled in greeting. She closed the door behind her and moved gracefully to his bedside. She was incredibly beautiful, he thought again. Why had she been kidnapped? What would Balinor know about her? What answers could he supply? She stood next to the bedside looking down at him, studying him with those clear, deep eyes for a moment. You look very well, Prince of Lee, she smiled. The rest and the food have made you whole again. How did you know who— Your sword bears the markings of the King of Lee. That much I know. Who else but his son would carry such a weapon? But I don't know you by name. Menyon, the Highlander responded, somewhat surprised at the girl's knowledge of his little homeland, a kingdom unfamiliar to most Outlanders. The young woman stretched forth a slim, bronzed hand to grasp his own in warm greeting and nodded happily. I am Sherl Ravenlock, and this is my home, Menyon, the island city of Kern. If not for your courage, I should never have seen it again. For that I shall remain eternally grateful, and your friend always. Now finish your meal while we talk. She seated herself on the bed next to him and motioned for Menyon to continue eating. Again he began to raise his fork. Then, remembering the invasion, he dropped it to the tray with a noisy clatter.
"You've got to get word to Tirsis, to Balinor. The invasion from the Northland has begun. There is an army camped just above Kern waiting to—"
"I know. It's all right," Cheryl responded quickly, raising her hand to stop him from continuing.
"Even in your sleep you spoke of the danger.
You warned us before you passed out entirely. Word has been sent to Tirsis. Palance Buckhanner rules in his brother's absence. The king is still very ill. The city of Kern is mobilizing its defenses, but for the moment there is no real danger. The rains have flooded the Myrmidon and made any crossing by a large force impossible. We will be safe until help arrives."
"Balinor should have been in Tirsis several days ago," Menyon announced with alarm. "What about the Border Legion? Is it fully mobilized?"
The girl looked at him blankly, indicating that she had no idea what the situation was with regard to either the Legion or Balinor. Abruptly, Menyon shoved the tray aside and climbed out of bed, an astonished Cheryl rising with him, still trying to calm the excited Highlander.
"Cheryl, you may think that you're safe on this island, but I can guarantee that time is running out for all of us," Menyon exclaimed, reaching for his clothes. "I've seen the size of that army, and no amount of flooding is going to slow it down for long. And you can forget about any help short of a miracle."
He paused at the second button of his nightshirt, suddenly remembering the young woman with him. He pointed meaningfully to the door, but she shook her head negatively and turned away so she couldn't see him changing.
"What about your kidnapping?" Menyon asked, dressing himself quickly as he studied her slim back across the room. "Do you have any idea why you would be so important to the Northlanders? Other than the fact that you're a beautiful woman."
He smiled roguishly, a little of the brashness that Flick distrusted returning. Although he could not see her face, the Highlander was certain she was blushing furiously. She was silent a moment before speaking.
"I don't remember exactly what happened," the answer came at last. "I was asleep. I was awakened by a noise in the room. Then someone grabbed me, and I blacked out. I think I was struck, or... no, I remember now. It was a cloth soaked in some foul liquid that prevented me from breathing. I blacked out, and the next thing I remember was lying on the sand near the river. I gather it was the Myrmidon. You know how I was tied in that blanket. I couldn't see anything and could hear only a little, but nothing that I could understand. Did you see anything?"
Menyon shook his head and shrugged.
"No, nothing much," he added, remembering that the girl was not looking at him. "One man brought you across in a boat, then turned you over to four trolls. I couldn't see the man distinctly, but I might recognize him if I saw him again. How about answering my first question? Why would anyone kidnap you? Turn around. I'm dressed now."
The young woman turned obediently and came over next to him, watching curiously as he pulled on the high hunting boots.
"I'm of royal blood, Menyon," she responded quietly.
Menyon stopped quickly and looked up at her. He had suspected she was no ordinary citizen of Kern when she had recognized the crest of Lee on his sword. Now perhaps he would discover the reason behind her abduction from the city.
"My ancestors were kings of Kern, and for a while of all Callahorn before the Buckhanners came to power about 100 years ago. I am a... well, I guess you could say I'm a princess in absentia."
She laughed at the foolishness of the idea, and Menyon smiled back. "My father is an elder of the council that governs the internal affairs of Kern. The king is the ruler of Callahorn, but this is an enlightened monarchy, as the saying goes, and the king seldom interferes with the governmental workings of this city. His son Palance has been attracted to me for some time,
and it is no secret that he plans to marry me. I believe that to get to him, an enemy might try to harm me. Menyon nodded soberly, a sudden premonition springing into his alert mind. Palance was not in line for the throne of Callahorn unless something happened to Balinor. Why would anyone waste time trying to put pressure on the younger son unless they were certain that Balinor would not be around? Again, he recalled Shirl's lack of knowledge of the arrival of the Prince of Callahorn, an event that should have taken place days ago and one that all the citizens of the land should have known about. "Shirl, how long have I been asleep?" he asked apprehensively. "Nearly an entire day," she answered. "You were exhausted when they pulled us from the Myrmidon yesterday morning, and I thought you should sleep. You gave us your warning." 24 hours lost," Menyon exclaimed angrily. "If not for the rain, the city would have already fallen. We've got to act now. But what? Shirl, your father and the council, I must speak with them." He grasped her arms with urgency when she hesitated. "Don't ask questions now, just do what I say. Where are the council chambers? Quick, take me to them." Without waiting for the girl to lead him, Menyon took her arm and propelled her through the door to a long hallway beyond. Together they hurried through the empty home and out the front doorway onto a wide, tree-shaded lawn, running to escape the persistent drizzle of the morning rain. The walkways of the buildings beyond were partially sheltered from the rain, and they were spared a second soaking. As they proceeded toward the council hall, Shirl asked him how he happened to be in this part of the country. But Menyon responded evasively, still unwilling to tell anyone about Alanon and the Sword of Shannara. He felt he could trust this girl, but Alanon's warning that none of those who journeyed to Paranor should reveal the story behind the missing sword prevented him from confiding even in her. Instead, he explained that he had come to aid Balinor at his request upon hearing of an impending Northland invasion. She accepted his story without question, and he felt a little guilty for lying to her. Yet Alanon had never told him the complete truth, so perhaps he knew less than he imagined anyway. They had reached the council hall, its ancient chambers housed within a tall stone structure surrounded by weathered columns and arched windows laced with metal latticework. The guards that stood leisurely next to the entryway did not question them, and they hurried inside, moving down the long, high corridors and up the winding stairways as the walls echoed with the rap of their boots on the worn stone flooring. The council met in chambers situated on the fourth floor of the great building. When at last they were outside its wooden doors, Shirl advised Menyon that she would inform her father and the other members of his wish to address them. Reluctantly, the Highlander agreed to wait. He stood quietly in the corridor after she had gone inside, listening to the hushed murmur of voices as the seconds ticked slowly away, and the rain continued to beat in a soft, steady rhythm on the glass of the windows that lined the silent hall. Losing himself for a moment in the peace and solitude of the ancient building, the Highlander recalled in brief flashes the faces of the divided company of friends, wondering sadly what had befallen them since Paranor. Perhaps they would never again be together as they had been during those fearful days on the road to the Druid's Keep, but he would never forget their courage and sacrifice, and the pride he felt now in recalling the dangers they had faced and overcome. Even the reluctant Flick had displayed a bravery and steadfastness that Menyon would not have expected from him. And what of Shay, his oldest friend? He shook his head as he thought about his missing companion. He missed the Veilman's peculiar mixture of hard-headed practicality and antiquated beliefs. Somehow Shay could not seem to see the change in times, even when the sun moved from east to west in the sky above. He did not seem to realize that the land and the people were growing, expanding once more, that the wars of the past were slowly being forgotten.
Shea believed that one could turn his back on the past and build a new world with the future, never understanding that the future was inextricably tied to the past, an interwoven tapestry of events and ideas that would never be entirely severed. In his own small way, the little Veilman was a part of the passing age, his convictions a reminder of yesterday rather than a promise of tomorrow. How strange. How incredibly strange it all seemed, Menyon thought suddenly, standing in the center of the hall, motionless, his gaze lost in the depths of the weathered stone wall. Shay and the Sword of Shannara. Things of an age slowly dying, yet they were the hope of the hour to come. They were the key to life. The heavy wooden doors to the council hall opened behind the Highlander, and his thoughts faded with Shirl's soft voice. She seemed small and vulnerable as she waited beneath the massive beams of the high entryway, her face beautiful and anxious. No wonder Palance Buchanna wanted this woman for his wife. Menyon moved toward her, taking her warm hand in his own, and they entered the council chamber. He noted the ancient austerity of the massive chamber as he moved into the gray light that seemed to slide in tired streaks through the high, iron-webbed windows. The council hall was old and proud, a cornerstone of the island city. 20 men were seated around a long, burnished wood table, their faces strangely similar as they waited for the Highlander to speak. All aged, wise, perhaps, and determined. The eyes betrayed the unspoken fear that lingered beneath the calm exteriors, a fear for their city and their people. They knew what the Northland army would do when the rains ceased and the waters of the Myrmidon receded in the heat of the open sun. He stopped before them, the girl still next to him, his footfalls dying away into the expectant silence. He chose his words carefully, describing the massive enemy force that had been assembled under the leadership of the warlock lord. He related in part the story of his long journey to Callahorn, speaking of Balinor and the men of the company formed at Cullhaven who were now scattered throughout the four lands. He did not tell them about the sword or about Shay's mysterious origin or even about Alanon. There was no reason for the elders of this council to know anything beyond the fact that the city of Kern stood in danger of being overrun. As he finished, calling upon them to save their people while there was still time, to evacuate the city immediately before all hope of retreat was cut off, he felt a strange sense of satisfaction. He had risked a great deal more than his own life to warn these people. If he had failed to reach them, they might all have perished without ever having had a chance to flee to safety. It was important, really important, to the Prince of Lee that he had carried out his task responsibly. The questions from the members of the council came with cries of alarm when the Highlander had finished, some angry, some frightened. Menyon answered quickly, trying to stay calm as he assured them that the size of the Northland army was as awesome as he had described, and the threat of attack certain. Eventually, the initial furor died away into a more rational deliberation of the possibilities. A few of the elders believed that the city should be defended until Palance Buchanna could come up from Tirsis with the Border Legion, but most were of the opinion that once the rains subsided, as they were certain to do within a few days, the invading army would easily gain the shores of the island and the city would stand defenseless. Menyon listened silently while the council deliberated the matter, weighing in his own mind the courses of action open to them. Finally, the flushed, gray-haired man, whom Shirl had introduced as her father, turned to Menyon, drawing him aside in private conference, as the council continued its debate.
"Have you seen Balinor, young man? Do you know where he can be found?"
"He should have been in Tirsis days ago," Menyon responded worriedly. "He was going there to mobilize the Border Legion in preparation for this invasion. He was in the company of two cousins of Eventine Elicidal. The older man frowned and shook his head, consternation registering in his lined face.
Prince of Lee, I must tell you that the situation is more desperate than it appears. The king of Callahorn, Rule Buckhanna, became seriously ill several weeks earlier, and his condition does not seem to be improving. Balinor was absent from the city at the time, and so the king's younger son assumed his father's duties. While he has always been a rather unsteady personality, he has of late seemed highly erratic. One of his first acts was to disband the Border Legion, reducing it to a fraction of its former size.
"Disbanded!" Menyon exclaimed in disbelief. "Why in the name—"
"He found them unnecessary," the other continued quickly, "so he replaced them with a small company of his own men. The fact of the matter is that he has always felt overshadowed by his brother, and the Border Legion was under the direct command of Balinor by the king's own order. It's highly probable that Palance felt they would remain loyal to the firstborn son of the king in preference to himself, and he has no intention of returning the throne to Balinor should the king die. He has already made this quite apparent. The commanders of the Border Legion and several close associates of Balinor were seized and imprisoned, all very quietly so that the people would not be outraged by this senseless action. Our new king has taken as his only confidant and adviser a man named Stenman, a viperous mystic and trickster whose only concern is for his own ambitions, not for the welfare of the people or even Palance Buckhanna. I do not see how we can hope to face this invasion with our own leadership so badly divided and undermined. I'm not even sure we can convince the prince that the danger exists until the enemy is standing at the open gates."
"Then Balinor is in grave danger," Menyon said darkly. "He has gone to Tirsis, not realizing that his father is ill and that his brother has taken command. We've got to get word to him at once."
The council members had suddenly risen to their feet, shouting heatedly, still arguing over what should be done to save the doomed city of Kern. Cheryl's father hastened to their midst, but it took several minutes for the few rational members of the distraught council to quiet the others enough to permit the discussion to continue on an orderly basis. Menyon listened for a little while, then allowed his attention to drift momentarily to the high, arched windows and the solemn sky beyond. It was not as dark as before, and the rain had begun to slacken further. Unquestionably, it would end by tomorrow, and the enemy force camped beyond the flooded Myrmidon would attempt a crossing. Eventual success in attaining a landing was assured, even if the vastly outnumbered soldiers stationed or living in Kern tried to defend the island. Without a large, well-organized army to protect the city, the people would be quickly slain, and Kern would fall. He thought back quickly to his parting with Alanon, wondering suddenly what the resourceful druid would do if he were there. The situation was not promising. Tirsis was ruled by an irrational, ambitious usurper. Kern was leaderless, its councilmen divided and unsure, debating a course of action that should already have been executed. Menyon felt his temper slipping. It was madness to ponder the alternatives further.
"Councilmen, hear me!"
His own voice rose in fury, reverberating back from the ancient stone walls as the voices of the elders of Kern died into whispering silence. "Not only Callahorn, but all of the Southland, my home and yours, faces certain destruction if we do not act now. By tomorrow night, Kern will be ashes and its people enslaved. Our one chance for survival is escape to Tirsis. Our one hope for victory over this mighty Northland army is the Border Legion, reassembled under Balinor.
The Elven armies stand ready to fight with us. Eventine will lead them. The dwarf people, engaged for years in fighting the gnomes, have promised to aid us. But we must stand fast separately until all are united against this monstrous threat to our existence. Your plea is well spoken, Prince of Lee, Shirl's father responded quickly as the flushed Highlander paused. But give us a solution to our immediate problem so that our people can reach Tirsis. The enemy is camped directly across the Myrmidon, and we stand virtually defenseless. We must evacuate almost 40,000 people from this island, and then guide them safely to Tirsis, which is miles to the south. Undoubtedly, the enemy has already posted sentries all around our shores to prevent any attempt to cross the Myrmidon before the assault on Kern. How can we overcome such obstacles?
A fleeting smile crossed Menyon's lips.
We'll attack, he stated simply.
For a moment there was shocked silence as they all stared in utter disbelief at the deceptively passive face. The words of astonished reply were still forming on their lips as he held up one hand.
An attack is exactly what they will not be expecting, particularly if it comes in the night. A quick strike against a flank position of their main encampment, if executed properly, will confuse them, cause them to think that it's an assault by a heavily armed force. The darkness and the confusion will hide our true size. Such an attack is certain to draw in their outlying sentry lines around the island. A small command can make a great amount of noise. Set a few fires and pin them down for at least an hour, perhaps longer. While that's going on, evacuate the city.
One of the elders shook his head negatively.
Even an hour would not be sufficient time, though your plan may be daring enough to catch the Northlanders off guard, young man. Even if we manage to ferry all 40,000 people from the island to the southern shore, it will still be necessary to march them southward to Tirsis. Almost 50 miles. The women and children would require days to travel that distance under normal conditions, and once the enemy finds Kern has been abandoned, they'll follow its people southward. We cannot hope to outrun them. Why should we even attempt it?
You will not have to outrun them, Menyon declared quickly. You won't be taking these people south by land. You will take them down the Myrmidon. Put them in small boats, rafts, anything that you now have or can build by tonight that will float. The Myrmidon flows southward deep into Callahorn, within 10 miles of Tirsis. Disembark at that point, and all can easily reach the safety of the city by daybreak, long before the cumbersome Northland army can mobilize and follow.
The council rose to its feet, shouting their approval, caught up in the fire and determination of the Highlander spirit. If there was any way that the people of Kern could be saved, even though the island city itself must fall to the enemy hordes, it must be tried. The council adjourned after a short discussion to mobilize the working people of the city. Between this time and sunset, every citizen who was able to assist would be expected to aid in the construction of large wooden rafts capable of transporting several hundred people. There were already hundreds of small boats scattered about the island which individual citizens used to navigate the river in order to reach the mainland. In addition, there were a number of larger ferries for mass transportation which could be pressed into service. Menyon suggested that the council order all armed soldiers in the city to begin a vigilant patrol of the coastline, permitting no one to leave the island. All details of the planned escape would be carefully concealed from everyone but the council members for as long as possible. The Highlanders' greatest concern was that someone might betray them to the enemy, cutting off their escape route before they had a chance to act. Someone had seized Shirl in her own home, whisked her out of the heavily populated city, and ferried her across into the hands of the trolls. a chore that could not have been accomplished by anyone unfamiliar with the island. Whoever he was, he remained free and hidden, perhaps still safe within the city. If he learned the exact details of the evacuation plan, he would undoubtedly attempt to warn the Northlanders. Secrecy was absolutely necessary if this dangerous venture was to be successful. The remainder of the day passed quickly for Menyon. Forgotten for the moment were Shay and his companions of the past few weeks. For the first time since Shay had come to him in the Highlands, the Prince of Lee was faced with a problem that he fully understood, requiring skills he knew how to employ. The enemy was no longer the Skull King or the spirit creatures that served him. The enemy was flesh and blood, creatures that lived and died according to the same rules as other men, and their threat was one the Highlander could appreciate and analyze. Time was the greatest single factor in his plan to outwit the waiting army, and so he threw himself into the most important undertaking of his life, the saving of an entire city. Together with the members of the council, he directed the building of the giant wooden rafts which would be utilized to convey the majority of the besieged citizens of Kern down the still-flooded Myrmidon to the safety of Tirsus. The point of embarkation was to be the southwest coastline immediately below the city proper. There was a broad but well-concealed inlet from which the rafts and smaller boats would be launched under cover of darkness. Directly across the river from the inlet stood a series of low bluffs that ran to the edge of the embankment. Menyon thought that a handful of men could ford the river when the main attack on the enemy encampment began later that night. Once across, they could subdue the small guard post that would be keeping watch. After the sentries were dispatched, the boats and rafts would be launched, flowing downriver with the current, following the south branch of the Myrmidon to Tirsus. There was nothing to assure them that the vessels would not be spotted instantly, but it was the only possible course of action. Menyon believed that if the sky remained clouded, the sentry commands were withdrawn upriver to defend against the fake assault on the main encampment, and the people of the city kept silent on the rafts, then the evacuation might be successful. But toward late afternoon, the rain started to slacken off altogether, and the clouds began to thin out, permitting small strips of blue to seep through the rolling grayness. The storm was drawing to an end, and it appeared the night sky would be cloudless and the land exposed to the revealing light of the new moon and 1,000 winking stars. Menyon was seated in one of the smaller rooms of the council hall when he saw these first signs of a clearing, his attention momentarily diverted from the huge map spread out on the table before him. At his side were two members of the disbanded Border Legion, Jonas Senpre, the lieutenant commander of the Legion and the highest-ranking officer on the island, and a grizzled veteran named Fandres. The latter knew the country around Kern better than anyone and had been called in to advise the attack squad in its strike against the giant Northland army. Senpre, his superior, was surprisingly young for his rank, but a sharp and determined soldier with 12 years of field duty already behind him. He was a devoted follower of Balinor, and like Menyon, he was considerably upset to learn that nothing had been heard from Tirsus concerning the prince's arrival. Earlier that afternoon, he had selected 200 seasoned soldiers from the disbanded Border Legion to form the strike force that would be directed against the enemy camp. Menyon had offered his aid, and it had been eagerly accepted. The Highlander was still cut and bruised about the feet and lower legs from his arduous flight after rescuing Shurl Ravenlock, but he refused to stay behind with the evacuation party when the feint by the small attack squad had been his idea. Flick would have written off his insistence as a foolish mixture of stubbornness and pride, but Menyon Lee would not be left in comparative safety on the island while a